May it please the court, my name is David Yoon. I have the privilege of representing the plaintiff, appellant Blair Kittleson. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
That'll be up to you to keep track of.
Thank you. We raised 3 issues on appeal. One, whether the probate court erred in interpreting the trust. Two, whether the probate court erred in granting summary judgment on our breach of fiduciary duty claim. And three, whether the probate court abused its discretion in finding that Mr. Kittleson's lawsuit was groundless and frivolous. Due to limited time, I'll address the first 2 issues and rely on our brief on the remaining issues. Moreover, because my arguments concerning the first 2 issues will necessarily demonstrate that the lawsuit was not groundless or frivolous, unless the court has any questions, I will not address the 3rd issue. Before presenting my arguments, it's important to keep in mind several key events. On November 23, 2011, Mr. Kittleson's mother died. On December 29, 2011, Mr. Kittleson's home was appraised based on the date of death value. The net equity on the home at the time of death was $634,000. On January 13, 2012, 2 months later, the trustee offered to sell the home to any of the beneficiary on the date of death value. On August 22, 2012, 9 months later, the trustee filed a tax return swearing the values of the residuary estate, each beneficiary's share, and the value of the home on the date of death. Those values demonstrated that Mr. Kittleson's share was greater than the net equity value of the home. Despite this evidence, the trustee has refused to allocate the home to Mr. Kittleson's share. With this background in mind, I'll address the first issue regarding the interpretation of the trust. As this court knows, the interpretation of a trust is a legal question reviewed de novo. In interpreting a trust, the settlor's intent must be given effect. The probate court here erred in interpreting the trust by at least 3 different ways. First, the probate court emphasized that the main purpose of the trust was to divide the residuary estate into 5 equal shares. However, the probate court disregarded or did not give sufficient weight to the other important intent of the settlor. The settlor wanted Mr. Kittleson to live and keep the home that he and his family lived in for 35 years. Specifically, Article 1-6 of the Second Amendment states, if the assets of the residuary trust estate include any residential property occupied by a child of the settlor at the settlor's death, such residential property, to the extent possible, shall be allocated to that child. This provision was specifically intended for Mr. Kittleson. If, as the probate court found, the settlor's only intent or overarching intent was to divide the residuary estate into 5 equal shares, it would not have included the language allowing the residential property to be allocated to Mr. Kittleson. If the settlor only wanted the children to have equal shares, it would have just required a trustee to liquidate everything and to divide it up equally. But that's not what the trust says. It says it added the language to allocate the home to Mr. Kittleson to the extent it was possible. The probate court is simply wrong that Mr. Kittleson will get a greater share if the home is allocated to him on the date of death valuation. It only results in an unequal distribution to the extent the real estate market increases or decreases the value of the home. If, for example, the real estate market, as it happened in this case, goes up after Mrs. Kittleson's death, of course, Mr. Kittleson's share becomes larger. However, it was equally possible that the real estate market went down, in which case Mr. Kittleson's share would be less. I think it was fundamental error for the probate court to rely on the real estate market, the fluctuation, to determine the proper interpretation of the trust. Second point, the probate court erred in finding that there's no language in any of the trust document which directs distribution of any trust asset at the date of death. That's simply incorrect. Division of residuary estate is specifically governed by Section 1-6 of the Second Amendment. It provides, at the settlor's death, the trustee shall divide the residuary estate. In fact, the trust goes on to say if one of the children was living in the home, again, at the settlor's death, it shall be allocated to that child. Therefore, the Second Amendment actually designates that the home should be allocated at the time of death rather than some other date of the trustee's choosing. What the probate court did here, however, is even worse. The probate court did not value the home at the time of death or at the time of distribution. The probate court actually rejected all of the appraisals that were presented at the hearing or at the trial. Instead, the probate court ordered a new appraisal following the trial over 2 years after the death. The new appraisal, which valued the home on December 3, 2013, was accepted even without a hearing.
Well, did Mr. Kittleson file any sort of an objection to the probate court's considering the December 2013 appraisal?
No, not specifically, Your Honor. But the appraisal was submitted on December 3, I believe it was December 3rd date, and in the order of December 20th, in response to the a number of other issues like attorney fees, the court accepted it.
Without objection?
We did ask that that issue was not specifically before the court. The court ordered after the hearing that a new appraisal shall be done, and then I think after several telephonic hearings, it was accepted. But certainly we didn't have an opportunity to cross-examine anybody, and there was nobody to do that, and the court apparently accepted it.
Sorry to interrupt. How do you address Article 3-3.2 of the agreement?
Sure, Your Honor. That section governs the general powers of the trustee, and it states, in part, in administering or distributing any trust under this agreement, the trustee may distribute in cash or kind or partly in each at fair market value on the date of distribution and without requiring pro rata distribution on a specific asset.
So that
we submit that provision doesn't say anything about allocation of the residential property or the valuing of the residential property. That provision largely governs when you are selling the assets and distributing cash. And even to the if the court believes that the general power is inconsistent with 1.6 of the Second Amendment, 1.1-6 would certainly govern because it is the latest and more specific provision. But what the probate court did here was, as I mentioned, they didn't rely on the date of distribution to value the home. She picked December 3rd, 2013. There's absolutely no support in the trust document for that. The probate court also erred in, well, let me, unless the court has questions regarding the trust document, I would like to go to the breach of fiduciary duty issue because of the limited time. Here, as this court knows, summary judgment is a drastic remedy and should only be granted upon a clear showing that there are no genuine issues of material fact. There are multiple reasons why the summary judgment should not have been granted. First, Mr. Kittleson submitted affidavits creating disputed issues of material fact. Mr. Kittleson submitted sworn affidavits from his experts opining that the trustee breached its fiduciary duties to Mr. Kittleson, including those duties independent of the trust. And then Mr. Kittleson submitted his own affidavit stating that the trustee's breach of fiduciary duty caused him economic and non-economic damages, including emotional distress damages. Under these circumstances, summary judgment was inappropriate because there were disputed issues of material fact.
Let's assume, just for purposes of my question, that we will agree with the lower court's interpretation of the trust instrument, and that we will agree with the lower court's factual findings on breach of fiduciary duty. What would be, and I'm not asking you to concede that, that's just an assumption, what then would be the purpose in reversing the summary judgment and remanding for what?
Because the breach of fiduciary duty claim did not just encompass the selling of the home. The breach of fiduciary duty was broader than that.
What, how did the bank breach fiduciary duty other than as related to, you know, not distributing the home, valuing it at a certain time?
Certainly. One of the main things was we argued that the trustee aligned itself with the other beneficiaries.
Okay, but what's the consequences of that other than how the home was handled?
And submitted, and then after aligning itself, they had a meeting. The trustee had a meeting without inviting Mr. Kittleson.
How was
after the meeting, they obtained new appraisals.
And if all, how was he, if the new appraisal was consistent with the trustee's fiduciary duty to fairly value the assets, how was Mr. Kittleson damaged by this alleged alignment or by meeting with the other beneficiaries where this new appraisal theory is discussed?
We argued that he submitted affidavit that he has emotional distress damages being alienated from his own family, extended family. He submitted affidavit to that extent. He also has a right to recover attorney fees for breach of trust. And he has administration fees. And all of those damages were not considered. And the court will remember, we had two experts who were present, was ready to testify about the breaches of fiduciary duty. We presented no evidence of breaches of fiduciary duty. Specifically, we didn't present the expert opinions of Jim Durka, and we limited Mr. Whitmer's testimony to just the interpretation of trust. Therefore, it would be unfair to grant summary judgment based on incomplete record when there was no evidence presented on breaches of fiduciary duty. Since I only have 2 minutes, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Ann Gill. I represent U.S. Bank, and Leslie Kay, who's at council table, also represents the other beneficiaries of the Virginia Fox Kittleson Trust. First, I'd like to thank you for the courtesy of rescheduling this oral argument based on my health issues. I appreciate the courtesy and also the courtesy of Mr. Yoon agreeing to that. Mr. Yoon started off by presenting some of the facts which he thinks has set up the issues in this case. I would like to present additional facts which I think are critical to understanding the intent of the Virginia Fox Kittleson Trust. This trust was first created in 1974. At that time, the purpose of the trust was to divide the residuary estate equally among the surviving children, and there were 5 children. There were subsequent amendments to that 1974 trust. The critical amendment here was in the second amendment in 1987, when the Virginia Fox Kittleson added additional provisions to that trust. She maintained the purpose over dividing the residuary estate equally amongst the children who survived her. But for one of the five children, she specifically provided that a spendthrift trust would be created and that the one-fifth share would go straight into the spendthrift trust rather than directly to Larry Kittleson Jr. That provision also provided that to the extent possible, any child living in a residence owned by the trust would be allocated to the extent possible. At the time of that 1987 amendment to the trust, the residence at issue was not owned by Virginia Fox Kittleson, her trust, or Blair Kittleson. It was owned by a bank which had foreclosed upon it. Subsequently, Virginia Kittleson purchased the house and owned it outright in her own name for several years before she placed it in the trust. Subsequent to those actions, she never amended those provisions of the trust. However, that amendment which created the spendthrift trust created in Article 1.8 the terms of the spendthrift trust, which identified that the beneficiaries of this one-fifth share would be Blair Kittleson Jr., his wife, and his issue, and that this class remains open until the earlier of Blair Jr.'s death or 25 years after Virginia's death. So this class remains open probably until the year 2036, unless Blair Jr. dies earlier. And at trial, on his deposition, he testified that he has no reason to believe he will not live for at least 25 years. So the trustee, at the time of the death of Virginia Fox Kittleson in November of 2011, was looking at the spendthrift trust and the open class of beneficiaries and how to fulfill the fiduciary duties both to the beneficiaries of the Virginia Fox Kittleson Trust and the spendthrift trust, which had an open class of beneficiaries. Interestingly, the spendthrift trust did not limit itself to the standard provisions of the trust of providing for health, education, needs, and support. Mrs. Kittleson had a much more generous definition of benefits for this class. She included comfort and welfare of this class of beneficiaries. This is an extremely broad and somewhat unusual description of benefits to be provided and guided the trustee in looking at what would be the needs of this class of beneficiaries. Mr. Young made a point of the 706, the federal estate tax document. That document has to present the date of death values of the assets of the trust. Pursuant to duties to provide that 706 tax return, the property was initially appraised, and the first appraisal came in with a value of $795,000. However, in the following months, reliable questions were raised to the trustee that might have been an incorrect appraisal, that it might be higher. So the trustee did comply with his fiduciary duties to provide accurate tax information and obtained a second appraisal, which did reflect a higher value of the residence. Meanwhile, back in January of 2012, the trustee, through its officer, Mr. Garcia, sent a letter to all of the beneficiaries, the family members, and in that letter he outlined the process of collecting the assets of the trust, appraising them, complying with the tax requirements of filing taxes, and indicated that final distribution would not occur until after final taxes had been filed and paid. That January letter has been characterized in different ways. I would ask you to look specifically at that letter in the record. That it starts, I believe, on the court file on page 849. I believe that letter offers to sell any assets of the trust to the beneficiaries, but does not specify date of death values. It says that there will be appraisals and that the request that any beneficiaries contact the trustee if they wish to purchase any of the assets. None of the beneficiaries responded to that letter. Subsequently, in April of 2012, a series of correspondence began in which the trustee indicated once again, that the intent would be to liquidate the assets of the trust in order to distribute 5 equal shares. At about this time, Mr. Blair Kittleson Jr.'s lawyer indicated that he was interested in having the residence allocated to him, not to Spencer's Trust, but to him. And he presented through his lawyer the argument that the residence had been appraised at $795. If you subtract the mortgage from that, he then argued that the value of the house was some $637,000 or $634,000. However, subtracting the mortgage from the appraised value shows only the equity, not the fair market value of the house. All of his arguments on allocating a 1/5 share to himself, not the Spencer's Trust, start with the equity value, not the appraised value. There was back and forth about this that resulted in the Blair Jr. filing his complaint in June of 2012, in which he asserted that the residence should be allocated to him at the date of death value. Subsequently, 1 month later, the trustee filed a petition for instructions under Probate Code 1516-201, requesting instructions from the court as to what its fiduciary duty was in this situation. That petition for instructions spelled out in detail the fact that the trustee thought it was not possible to allocate the residence to the Spendthrift Trust because it would only fund that share and not leave the liquidity necessary to create the benefits intended in the Spendthrift Trust for that open class of beneficiaries. The motion for summary judgment on breach of fiduciary duty addressed the fact that you first have to interpret the trust documents as to whether there was a mandatory provision to allocate the residence to the Spendthrift Trust. I submit to you that it does not. That is a qualified direction. It's only to the extent possible.
Let me pursue that, and I'm going to ask you kind of the converse of the question I asked Mr. Young. Let's assume we agree with you and with the lower court as to how the trust should be interpreted. Why isn't Mr. Kittleson still entitled to go forward on the claims that were foreclosed by summary judgment to the extent that he claims emotional distress as a result of the bank's aligning itself with the other beneficiaries, you know, wholly separate and apart from the bank's ultimate decision to sell rather than allocate the house?
I think that he is not entitled to recover because at that point the fiduciary had not, excuse me, the trustee had not acted. It had identified the fact that there was a dispute about the acts or conduct and exercise of powers and requested instructions at that time.
But isn't, and I apologize for interrupting, but that, I mean, that seems to me to be a factual dispute of which you may very well have the better side, but we're talking about a summary judgment. He puts in evidence, his own affidavit, his experts that say the bank did such and such and so and so. The experts say that's a breach of fiduciary duty and it caused me emotional distress. Why doesn't that give him the right to a trial on damages?
I think that although he asserts that those raise genuine issues of material fact, I think that they do not raise genuine issues of material fact. In the supplement to the petition for instructions, the trustee submitted its own expert opinion in which it interpreted the trust documents as in which it said that the trustee had not breached any fiduciary duties, that all the items in which Mr. Kittleson requested as economic damages were anticipatory, and that they was not a breach of fiduciary duties, and that any issue about whether there might have been a breach was wiped out by the trustee promptly requesting instructions from the probate court as to how to proceed.
How can the request for instructions wipe out damages from a breach if the breach had already occurred, i.e. the bank's align, as was alleged, the bank's aligning itself and adopting a strategy recommended, if not dictated, by the other beneficiaries?
I find it interesting that they have never identified the date of this alignment. My understanding is that once the complaint was filed, naming the other siblings and the bank as co-defendants was when they met and determined whether they could proceed. All of the siblings indicated that their position was that they were entitled to an equal one-fifth share from the Virginia Kittleson Trust. I believe at trial, Mr. Blair Kittleson also conceded he was entitled only to a one-fifth share going into the Spendthrift Trust. So in that sense, they all had the same position, that there was supposed to be an equal one-fifth division of the Virginia Fox Kittleson Trust. So to that extent, they all had the same position. It was just a question which was determined at its declaratory judgment trial whether it was possible to allocate the residence to the Spendthrift Trust and still meet the provisions of the Spendthrift Trust to provide for that open class of beneficiaries. Following the fact that of the declaratory judgment and the fact that the trust document in Article 3, powers of the trustee directs that the distribution may be at fair market value at the date of distribution, it was only prudent to obtain another appraisal of the residence, which is the appraisal in the December of 2013. At that time, Mr. Kittleson Jr. was still stating that he wanted to purchase the house, and it was only be fair amongst all the beneficiaries to determine the fair market value of the residence at that time. Even though that appraisal was submitted, he did not object to it. He still indicated that he wished to purchase the house, and that he still continued that position through the subsequent proceedings on the motion for attorney's fees, even after there was a final judgment and the appeal had been filed, and he indicated he wanted to purchase the residence. The trustee indicated that it was accept as a supersedious bond to stay any efforts to market the property of only one half of the appraised value in an effort to work with Mr. Kittleson Jr. He still did not post that bond, and he still has not demonstrated either at the trial or through the discovery process that he has the financial wherewithal to purchase the property as he has indicated he wanted. That supports the probate court's determination that he's pursued this litigation to prevent the marketing of the house for as long as possible. He was able to stay in that property for 2.5 years after Virginia Kittleson's death. He paid rent only starting in April of 2012. Prior to his mother's death, he did pay some of the expenses of the house, but as the trustee set forth and had numerous correspondences, just the maintenance of the house runs at some $30,000 a year, and that's without looking at major maintenance expenses that a house that old is likely to incur. He has never demonstrated an ability to purchase or equalize so that that residence could be allocated to the Spendthrift Trust. I ask you to affirm the probate's judgments in all respects. Thank you, Your Honors.
As Your Honor knows, trustee owes a duty of impartiality. On the date they answered the complaint, the trustee and all the four beneficiaries was aligned together as defendant, and one attorney represented all of them against Blair Kittleson.
Well, did Mr. Kittleson's affidavit or the affidavits of his experts identify facts concerning this alignment that predated the trustee's request for instructions?
Yes, the affidavit said that they aligned themselves with the four beneficiaries. Subsequently, or I don't know if they specified all of the facts, but the expert opinions stated that the trustee aligned itself with the four beneficiaries.
But were the dates of specific acts by the trustee identified that were prior to the trustee seeking instructions from the court?
Well, the In response to our, there was some of your petition, we submitted affidavit delineating the various breaches of fiduciary duty, and that included alignment with the other four beneficiaries. Am I not answering your question?
Well, maybe a detail point that's, you know, you wouldn't pick up on since you weren't trial counsel, so go ahead with your argument.
So that's one, and also, counsel mentioned the 706 filing on the eve of trial. That itself shows the breach of fiduciary duty, Your Honor. On the eve of trial, they submitted another amendment to 706, and we never got to present evidence that continuously getting new appraisals is in violation or a breach of fiduciary duty. So that is itself, and anyway, in conclusion, Your Honor, Blair Kittleson brought this lawsuit in order to keep a home that he lived in for 35 years. He not only lost the home that he lived in, but he was required to pay nearly $250,000 in attorney fees and costs. We ask that the court reverse the probate court's entry of summary judgment, find that the home should have been allocated to his distributed share, vacate the award of attorney fees and costs, and remand for further proceedings. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. And Ms. Gill, it's nice to see that you're up and running. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.